Working Cows Podcast, episode 92, bonus episode.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, here with a very special episode. Had the opportunity to sit down with R. Nelson Nash, the founder of the infinite banking concept, the guy who literally wrote the book, Becoming Your Own Banker, who has inspired people like Mary Jo Erman, who's been a guest a few times, and had an opportunity to sit down with him just before he passed away and record this episode, and I'm really thankful for that opportunity. And this is a companion episode with an episode that should be released at the same time as this episode, episode 93 with Carlos Lara. And in this episode, Nelson is going to plant some seeds of doubt about the official story. And so I would encourage you to take this episode as an opportunity to sit down and to just hear from someone who's been immensely studied over the course of his life on these issues. And maybe some of these things are going to be new to you. Maybe some of these history things are going to be fresh perspectives. And I would just say that the victor writes the history book. And so sometimes we don't hear every piece of the history. And I would also say that there's an opportunity here for you to do some of your own homework and to hear from Nelson's perspective on history. And so just listen in, and maybe some of these names will be new names, or maybe you're familiar with these names and you've got a preformed idea about their ideas. And I would encourage you to maybe look under the surface, look beyond that. And I'm not endorsing or saying that any of the names that Nelson mentions are names that shouldn't be on the list of historians that you are being influenced by. But Nelson's going to take a deep dive here into the deep history of financial trouble in our world. And we're going to follow this up with L. Carlos Lara, and we're going to look at the recent history of financial trouble in our world, and maybe even some of the future and how we prepare from financial trouble in our world. So just come at this with an open mind. Do your own homework. Read the books that Nelson will encourage you to read. The show notes page for today is going to be a very robust show notes page at workingcows.net/92. So I would encourage you to just sit back. Take this not necessarily as one of those driving or in the tractor or in your shirt pocket while you're out fixing fence episodes. Take this as a, I'm going to turn off the TV tonight. I'm going to listen to this episode. I'm going to take some notes. I'm going to do my own homework. I'm going to make up my own mind about the names and the people that are being listed here. And I'm going to keep an open perspective and not say that the corporate media is the one who gets to determine truth, but there is just one truth that's existent. And that truth is discoverable if we're willing to do the work and not just take in the perspective of others. So maybe we're up to the longest introduction in the history of the Working Cows podcast, but this episode is brought to you by the High Plains Ranch Practicum. I had a great conversation with Aaron Berger earlier today, and I want to share that with you in advance of it coming out, because by the time his episode comes out, the deadline for the registration for the High Plains Ranch Practicum will have already passed. And this is some of Aaron's perspective on what makes the High Plains Ranch Practicum such a special class and such a special opportunity for those people.
I'm really excited about this class. This is going to be the last one that we do. Really have an excellent lineup of presenters, ranchers who have been in the industry, who are effective and good at what they do. And that together with, I think, the curriculum that we provide really provides a great learning experience. And the camaraderie, exchange of ideas, the opportunity to challenge one another really fosters an environment where I think learning occurs. And so excited about this last High Plains Ranch Practicum, and would encourage folks, if they would like to still participate and they're hearing this podcast, give us a call, and if we can get you in, we will.
All right, so we're going to – I didn't want to interrupt Nelson. Just such a special opportunity to record an episode with him before his passing. And this episode, like my episode with Carlos Lara, the companion episode to this episode, is one of those where I want you to stick around at the end. I've got some things I want to share at the end, just kind of maybe a bit of a tribute to R. Nelson Nash and his willingness to just open up and talk to me and allow me to record the conversation and to share it with you guys. So stick around at the end, and I'll have some more to share. And here is my interview with R. Nelson Nash of the Nelson Nash Institute. Nelson, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
Good to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
So when you look at the financial and economic landscape of our world today, specifically the United States and its economy, are you satisfied with its stability and its long-term sustainability?
Oh, heavens no. There's no way. It's just one of those things that's there that we've got to cope with, and people have got to recognize what's going on and learn how to seize from the system. You don't do that politically. You do that individually. That's what people unfortunately don't understand.
What is it that causes you to believe that there are issues in our current economic system?
Well, it boils down to money, Pastor. It's just the fact that we cannot live the way that we live without the concept of money. Unfortunately, it's in the hands of the wrong people, bankers. There is truly evil there, but people do not understand the evil nature of it.
What is it that they are doing to or with the money that is causing the issues that you see in the system?
They're causing people to be slaves. That's all. But these things happen over such a long period of time that people don't see it happening to them. And that's why the article by Paul Rosenberg is so apropos, that people are not conscious of the environment in which they operate, and as a result, they're being manipulated into slavery, financial slavery. The banking function is in the hands of the wrong people, and it can people can secede from it, but they've got to understand that they can't do it by thinking that the way the world teaches.
And that, I think I'm free to link to that at the show notes page. Mm-hmm. I'm free to link to that article that you sent me from Paul Rosenberg.
Oh, yes, by all means.
That stuff is all going to be linked at workingcows.net/92. I'll throw a link to that article up there, and people can go and read that, and mm-hmm. basically it's making the argument that we've been in this same system for so long that we don't realize that we're in the system.
Yeah, it's the nature of human beings, but that's the fundamental there that is overlooked, that we're born with a proclivity to reject God.
Right. What is the current system that we live under as far as economics and finance are concerned? What are the characteristics of that system?
Oh, it's the epitome of the top-down bit that's going on. In fact, you cannot understand the last 135 years of the of our current history without understanding the mind of Cecil Rhodes. But who's ever heard of Cecil Rhodes, huh?
Can you tell me more about how Cecil Rhodes can help us inform our understanding of the last 135 years?
Sure. We're talking about the 1880s, 1890s, and we're talking about the influence of John Ruskin. He was an art critic and philosopher and so forth, and people were just enamored with what he had to say, and he influenced Cecil Rhodes big time. Now, Cecil Rhodes was a very rich man, and he's down in South Africa, and the British Empire was at its peak at that particular time, and he thought the British Empire was the greatest thing that ever happened, and there had to be a secret elite that actually ran things, that it wasn't government, it had to be the money powers. And so there's five people that they covered all the bases. Of course, there was Cecil Rhodes. You featured himself as head guy. Well, he only lived in 1902, but Alfred Milner was his successor, and what an evil man that guy was. Good grief. But whoever, again, has heard of him? Well, the one they have heard of is Nettie Rothschild. Well, there's money. And then there's W.T. Stead. And Stead was a newspaper man, and that's where the propaganda idea becomes in play. That you got to control people's minds by propaganda. And most of the stuff that we have going on out there today is nothing but pure, unadulterated propaganda. And, of course, then there's the connection with government, and that was, let's see, Lord Escher. Now, he had another name, but it got changed to Lord Escher. And he had the attention of the royalty of England. And so they had all the bases covered there. And so we end up with the bloodiest century of all time as a result of this. And it all has to do with money. Money is the common denominator. Have you ever heard of the Boer War, Pastor?
I don't believe so.
Oh, boy. All right. B-O-E-R. I knew there was a Boer War, but I didn't know what it was about, anything like that at all. And so about 14 months ago, I just was determined to find out what. The Boers were Dutch farmers. They were down in South Africa for over 200 years. Well, you ever heard of Kimberley in South Africa, the diamond mines, gold mines, and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
You heard of De Beers?
Right.
Okay. Well, there you go. We've got to go to the 10th commandment out there to really understand all this, to understand the mind of old Cecil Rhodes. The British Empire was, like you see, he thought that was the greatest thing that ever came along. Well, if you're king of the mountain, Pastor, what do you think your biggest fear is, sir?
Getting toppled.
Yes. Well, the Germans were coming along very well. Germany, as we know it today, is only 1871. Before that, it was fragmented into various areas, but they all came together then in 1871. Well, it was high-quality products and low prices and so forth, and threatened the British Empire. Well, as a satellite, you must understand that all the royalty of all those various nations there in Europe, they were related.
Mm.
And when you step back and see what was going on out there, there could never have been a world war without the British Empire. It was impossible. There's no such thing in the past, but the whole 20th century is the bloodiest century of all time. And it all comes from the envy thing there, the fear that the Germans is going to take over. And so the Boer War was just simply to do one thing, to get money to get going. Well, back then in the 1880s, the British went down there to clean out those Boers and get to that area, the Transvaal area, where all the richest spot on earth was there. Well, the British got their tails beat big time. They weren't used to that kind of war. That was humiliating the British Empire. Okay, so they come back in 1901 and 1902 with another method. They captured Boer women and children and put them in concentration camps, Pastor. Now, I'm 88 years old. I'm a product of World War II era. You know, we were taught by the propaganda machine that was just unbelievable that the bad guys was those Germans out there that created those concentration camps and so forth. And the truth was, it was the British. But again, our history books are certainly not going to tell us this sort of stuff because, you see, the secret elite controls education in this country, in the world. The secret elite controls the media totally. I haven't watched the news in over 18 months, and I refuse to do so because it's not news. It's propaganda totally. Well, next 8 years, we end up with the propaganda machine by W.T. Stead that was convincing the British that the Germans are going to invade them. And that was absurd. There's no way. But that's why propaganda is so important. It's almost as valuable as having money. But by all means, if you're going to fight a war, you got to have lots of money. Okay, so let's see what happened here. At the end of 1902, Cecil Rhodes dies and so forth, and W.T. Stead is doing his thing with propaganda. And guess what happened in 1910 at Jekyll Island, Georgia, you know?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, now, there had to be a central bank there and so forth, and the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Warburg. Paul Warburg was straight out of the house of Rothschild, straight out of the house of Kuhn Loeb Wall Street and so forth, and he was the architect of the document that became the Federal Reserve. Well, most people, again, say, well, that was in America. Well, people don't understand that these secret elite folks don't have nationalities. They're above all this sort of stuff. You know, have you ever heard of a guy named Carol Quigley?
I don't think so.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. He wrote this book, Tragedy and Hope, 1,347 pages, I believe.
I've heard of the book.
Okay, he's a great historian and so forth. And he was the guy who was the, influenced Bill Clinton more than anybody. Now, when you hear of a Rhodes scholar, tell me what comes to your mind, Pastor. When you hear somebody say, oh, he's a Rhodes scholar, what comes to your mind?
Smart.
Yeah. Well, it was a training camp. What he really is a training camp for the secret elite type folks. People don't get this sort of stuff in schools, but again, because they're totally controlled by the secret elite. But Carol Quigley is a guy that put us on to so much of this way back there, and he had a horrible time getting that first book written. And then his follow-up book was much smaller, but it was the idea of the Anglo-American establishment. As a sidelight, I did not put into my earlier conversation with you there that Cecil Rhodes saw that England had to recapture America, the USA.
Hmm.
Well, if you study this sort of stuff, you'll find out that that's just about what's been done.
Hmm.
But people aren't aware of this sort of thing at all. Well, so here's the thing. We're back to Jekyll Island, Georgia, 1910, and they do all their groundwork, and it's, this document becomes law. The last week of December 1913, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Between Christmas and New Year's Day, when most of the legislators were out of town and so forth, and they were totally illegal, but it got done. Well, Pastor, next week is 1914, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what happened just 8 months later? The Guns of August, World War One. See, there's a couple of books that go into this big time, and one of them is The Hidden Secret of the Origin of World War One. Now, the authors of that's Jim McGregor and Gary Dockery, and they had a dickens of a time getting that thing published because it was so revealing of the bad stuff that had gone on. Well, later on, they wrote a follow-up book, Prolonging the Agony, that when World War One started, there wasn't any reason for it to extend for longer than 6 months. All the British and the French had to do was just simply knock out the German ironworks and it's over, but that's not the object. The object was to totally destroy German people. And so it went on for 3.5 years. Have you ever heard of a place called Gallipoli?
No, sir.
Well, you ever heard of Constantinople?
Yes, sir.
You know where the Black Sea is?
Yes, sir.
You know where the Mediterranean is?
Yes, sir.
Well, there's one little narrow waterway there between the two, and that's at Constantinople. Well, and all this chicanery that was going on, the Russians had been lusting after Constantinople for over 200 years. I remember as a child talk about Constantinople and that waterway and so forth that the Russians wanted to do so badly. Well, Gallipoli is a peninsula in the Dardanelles just south of there. Now, the British Empire was all built on the naval abilities and so forth. As far as army, no, they weren't all that noteworthy, we'll put it that way. Okay, so the Russians are wanting the Constantinople, and the British Empire tells them, now, don't you worry, we'll conquer Constantinople and the Dardanelles and Gallipoli, and we'll give it to you. Well, that was all a hoax just to keep them get them involved in the war, because they wanted a war on either side of Germany there to kill as many Germans as they possibly could. Well, it was a tragedy to the British, and this was Churchill's one of his big mistakes, big time. And when you study that guy, what an evil fellow he was, but most folks have no earthly idea. We made him an honorary citizen, but when you find out what he was really like, my word, you're talking about the epitome of the secret elite. There you go. Well, you know, most people never heard of Gallipoli, but you can go to YouTube and just write in Gallipoli, and there's several videos there that help you understand and so forth. Well, later on during that 1st World War, down in what is now Iraq, there's a place called Kut, K-U-T, and that was an even bigger disaster for the British. But what people really don't understand is that most of the fighting at Gallipoli and Kut and so forth was by Indians, Australians, New Zealanders, and Canadians and folks like that. That's why people don't understand that there could never have been a world war without the British Empire. Well, back in November the 11th, we celebrated a holiday, didn't we?
Yes, sir.
What was it?
Well, it used to be called Armistice Day. Now it's called Veterans Day.
Have you noticed how they change the meaning of words out there to give it more acceptability, I guess, or something like that? Armistice, they laid down their arms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that wasn't the end of the war. There was a peace treaty with the Versailles Treaty. Do you know anything about the Versailles Treaty?
Yeah, it really messed with the Germans.
Oh, boy. Wilson said that if he had been a German, he would never have signed that thing. It was an awful, awful instrument that just tried to pin the blame on Austria, on Germany and Austria, which wasn't true at all. The actual start was started by the Russians under the influence of the British manipulating these folks. They had France on one side that they were manipulating. They had Russia on the other side there, and that was the ideal that they thought. Well, what our history books won't tell you is it is 8 months, I believe it is, that between the Armistice Day and the Versailles Treaty. Well, during that time, the British blockaded all the German ports, and they were starving to death. I mean, we're talking about 1,000 calories per day as being typical. Well, it takes 1,700 to survive. But the idea was to kill as many Germans as they possibly could. Well, so ultimately you had World War II, which there wasn't two world wars. There was one war with the recess there. That was all. That is all.
Yes, sir.
About 9 years later, here comes the beginning of everything and so forth. And they created Hitler. It's what happened, really happened. But who knows that? They don't study. They read the so-called history books or whatever. But there's a real good historian out there that's on YouTube called David Irving, R-V-I-N-G. And he says most of the history books is a guy sitting in the ivory tower. And he pulls down this particular history book and reads it. And he pulls down another one and reads it. And then he pulls down another one and reads that. And then maybe a fourth or fifth. And then he writes his own book. And so that's history. Well, he calls it intellectual incest. So, well, anyway, David Irving went to these places in Germany. David Irving was 3 years younger than me. He grew up in London and so forth. And if it weren't for him, we would never have really known about Dresden and so forth. But have you spent any time in Europe at all?
A little bit, yes, sir.
Okay, you've been to Cologne?
Nope, I've only been to... spent time on the ground in Ukraine, mainly.
Okay, well, you do know about the cathedral there in Cologne, right?
Mm-hmm.
Other than the cathedral, that city was leveled. Well, several other cities that were leveled. Now, I remember very vividly during my growing up time. See, I was a teenager during World War II. There was the constant use of the term unconditional surrender. Well, so we end up, come up with the second edition of the war there, what's World War II. All right, at the end of World War II, have you ever heard of Eisenhower's Rhine Meadows death camps?
No, sir.
Well, Google it. Eisenhower's Rhine Meadows death camps, the Rhine River. A meadow has no cover at all. There were more German soldiers killed after the war was over than during the war.
Hmm.
Now, what most folks don't know is that it wasn't Eisenhower's idea so much as it was Henry Morgenthau. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes, sir.
What an evil man. All right. The Morgenthau plan was to make a pasture land out of Germany. No industry would be allowed. Well, you see, so here's Mr. Churchill saying, oh, no, that would be inhumane, and so forth. So we can't do that. But somehow or another, $6 billion from the United States to Churchill changed his mind. Well, the Morgenthau plan didn't get fully implemented, but that was the whole idea more than anything else. But again, do you know of anybody who knows about Eisenhower's Rheinmetall's death camps?
I had never heard of it.
Well, I have a very good friend who's a doctor in Texas. Shucks, I can't remember the name of the town, but it's real close to a real bitty, little bitty town, Alvarado, which is south of Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Eb Land Samlowski, German. He had a brother who was also a doctor, but their father was a German doctor. And he survived one of those death camps.
Hmm.
Well, you see, that's real history. But who in the world would be talking about Samlowski in a history book, huh?
Hmm.
Because that's not done, so forth. Well, but the common denominator of all this is money, because that's where the power is. Well, you can secede from this by something called free contract with other free people. The law of contract prevails, but people don't understand that. Consider fish of the last to notice the water. All that years of top-down thinking and 4,000 of the 6,000 years is in the Old Testament. Well, there is 400 years between the Old and the New Testament, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
But how many people that are Christians don't understand that the New Testament is only covering about 75 years?
Right.
And really, it's only covering about 45, because the 30 years of Jesus Christ growing up is not all that noted in history.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, so Jesus Christ comes along with bottom-up thinking.
Mm-hmm.
When you go through that litany that DeSoto wrote there, you know, Jesus Christ gets baptized, and he's going to be starting his mission. He knows he's got a job to do. He's fully man, and he's fully God. Well, there's the period of temptation there, 40 days and 40 nights. Well, who's out there with him? Satan. Now, Satan as a spirit has been around for a long time. Jesus Christ as a human being has all been around 30 years. So I can imagine this kind of scenario that Satan is kind of saying to him, now look there, boy, to pull off this mission that you got to impress people.
Hmm.
Now, we've been out here 40 days and 40 nights. Aren't you hungry? Well, good grief, man, just turn these rocks into stone, these stones into bread. That will impress people. Get thee behind me, Satan.
Hmm.
Then he takes him out there to the high point, and shows him all these nations. He says, all those nations out there are mine. They have bought into my camp 100%. They are my slaves. Now, all you got to do is bow down and worship me, and I'll give them to you. Can't you see how easy that is? Get thee behind me, Satan. And then lastly, he says, now, look, boy, when you get back to town, find the highest spot in the temple. And you're looking down on all those people down there, and they're looking up at you. Just dive off. swan dive. Make it look beautiful. You're not going to get hurt, and you know it. Angels will rescue you. That will totally impress them. Well, Pastor, you think that's going to change the hearts of men? No. No way. No, it's got to be bottom up. Now, is there any evidence in the New Testament where Jesus Christ makes a decision that, you know, what I really need to do is go get affiliated with those Pharisees and Sadducees, get me a PhD under Gamaliel like Paul did? No, it can't work. That's more the top-down thinking that Paul Rosenberg is alluding to, so forth. It has to be bottom up. Jesus Christ is teaching cessation. Don't play their game. If you play their game, you're one of them. Well, you know, the Pharisees are not even mentioned until the New Testament. That's a fairly short period of time. Well, here's old Paul, the Pharisee of the Pharisees. He says, nobody got any higher than me. And he's on the road to Damascus, and you know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
The confrontation with Jesus Christ. Well, boy, that's got to be something. Knocked the living daylights out of him. Well, you know, it took him more than 10 years to get his head screwed on right.
Right.
And did you notice what he did when he finally was understanding that what Jesus Christ was getting across to him? Of all things, he goes back down there to Jerusalem and finds those Pharisees and essentially says, hey, guys, we got it all wrong. Look at what I found out. Well, do you think those guys are going to change their mind? Good Lord, heavens, no. Well, I got a feeling that, Joseph of Arimathea might have come around. And there was Nicodemus that he probably came around and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I might get to meet him in the not-too-distant future, those guys, in the not-too-distant future. But look at 1 Corinthians, first chapter. You know where Corinth is. Of course you do.
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans on the steroids. All those crazy beliefs and so forth. And so here's Paul and others with him that are trying to get this message across that you got this thing all wrong, that it's the blood of Jesus Christ that is our salvation, that sin is separation from God. Mm-hmm. And we have this natural proclivity to stray from God and so forth. But the wages of sin, being away from God, is death.
Yes.
All right, now, man is so stupid that he is doomed without understanding that. So all those thousands of years have demonstrated his stupidity, that he wants to be God. And God is a jealous God. He's not going to put up with that stuff. So the price has got to be paid. Jesus Christ is the only way out.
Mm-hmm.
The beliefs. Well, that's a totally different concept. All right, so what in the world did they do? Here's these people saying, oh, man, I'm a Paul. Oh, no, I'm of Apollos, so forth. They were concentrating on men rather than message. Mm-hmm. And Paul got on big time, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He said, I preach Jesus Christ and him crucified, and that is all.
Mm-hmm.
But human beings have a tendency to worship one another. Rosenberg nails it in that two-page passage.
Yes, sir.
But people can't recognize it. So, but in order to pull off all this stuff, it's always money. It is common denominator.
So was Ruskin's idea central planning? Was that what he was angling towards?
Oh, good. Oh, yes. No question. Yeah.
And then, yeah. So out of Ruskin's ideas and Cecil Rhodes and all those, we get the the central bank out of Jekyll Island, Georgia.
Yeah, you see the Jekyll Island, Georgia thing there, that 8 months. They knew they had been knowing for over 10 to 14 years they were going to have that war with Germany. They knew. Well, they got to have tons of money. And so the Federal Reserve created an open-ended supply of money. Just consider what's happened during my lifetime. Good grief. The quantity of money isn't solving things at all. My family is not noted for money, okay? We were poor as church mice, as they say, whatever. But we were rich in understanding of who's who in the play. And I became a Christian when I was 9 years old because I knew something was wrong out there big time. when I was out of college, I had 2 years of active duty with the Air Force because I was a ROTC student. Pastor, do you know what a second lieutenant's base pay was in 1952?
No, sir.
$213.75 a month, every month, whether you need it or not. $75 a housing allowance, $42 food allowance. And do you know we got along very well on that?
Mm.
It's not a quantity of money out there at all. But you see, when they open the floodgates out here, guess who runs the show?
Mm.
Bankers.
So how does a lot of what you've talked about this morning is related to our situation today. The central planning, the debasement of the German money supply, and the Weimar Republic happening between World War I and World War II. And, I was listening to a deal the other day, and it talked about the Weimar Republic and how this one guy had $68,000 or 68,000 marks in his savings account. And they came to him and said, we've got to liquidate your account, but we can't give you your money because the smallest mark being printed right now is 1 million marks. And so we've rounded up your account to 1 million. So that's good news.
Yep.
But the stamp that was on the letter that they sent to him was a 5 million mark stamp. So he was in the hole 4 million marks. And, and at that time, a loaf of bread was however many million marks. So how does the central planning and the debasement of money and all of that relate to where we are today?
Well, this is we have a hostile financial environment out there. But I've been teaching for the last 30 years you can do very well. You can survive and thrive in a hostile financial environment with free contract with other free people. You know, face it, that without the law of contracts, civilization will self-destruct.
Hmm.
And, let's go back to biblical times there, good grief. God made contracts with his people, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, covenants.
Well, yes. Well, the same contract applies today. If you believe. But so many Christians can't recognize the word if.
Hmm.
Yeah. We're promised eternal life, but it's if. And they can't understand that this earthly existence is nothing more than training camp for the eternal.
Hmm.
it takes us a while to get our stupid heads on straight and realize who's who in the play. Shakespeare, I keep telling people in seminars that I've done, he gave us a clue years ago. He said, all the world is the stage, and all the people are actors their own. I said, well, taking a hint from him, most people don't understand what the play is about.
Mm-hmm.
Worse than that, they get the characters in the play mixed up. They think they're God.
That's been the lie since the beginning.
That's the problem right there. Just learning how to secede from what's going on out there by free contract with other free people, that's the only answer.
So how does somebody go about seceding from the money system in our world today?
There's one instrument out there that that meets this totally, and that's dividend pay and whole life insurance. But again, who knows that, huh? But I spent 35 years now trying to get this across to people, and well, all these people that I've taught this to and so forth, they say, you changed my life. No, I did not. They changed their life. That, okay, this analogy will help out. I'm an aviator. Did you know that?
No, sir.
Okay, I've been flying airplanes 72 years. I've sold when I was 15 years old. It wasn't legal, but at the end of World War II, and there's a lot of things that were done that weren't legal and so forth. Well, anyway, I'm a forester by education. And I work privately in eastern North Carolina for 9 years as a consultant. I never worked for the government. Smokey Bear and I don't see eye to eye on much of anything. But anyway, I got active in Chamber of Commerce Act work and so forth. Smithfield was... North Carolina was 12,000 people at that time, and I became president of the chamber once while I was living there. Well, being an aviator, I had the privilege of selecting who's going to be the speaker at our annual meeting. Being an aviator, I picked William Piper, Piper Aircraft. And I'm 30 years old, and he's 74. Well, what a joy to spend time with a man like that and just, you know, learn some wisdom and so forth. But one message he did get across to our chamber, hopefully. He sure got it across to me. He says, you have a telephone. Big deal. If somebody else doesn't have a telephone, you don't have a thing.
Hmm.
So let's extrapolate that, Pastor.
Hmm.
You may have the greatest message in the world, and we know what that is, okay?
Yes.
Now, you may have the best means of communication available. You may have the best delivery of that message through that superior means of communication. But if you don't have an attentive listener, nothing happens. Inherently, mostly, like Rosenberg points out that one point of his two pages, inherently, most folks have a feeling something's wrong. Like I say, I recognized that when I was just 9 years old. Something is wrong. that we've got a problem. And there's one solution out there, and that's all, and that is Jesus Christ.
Hmm. Amen. So how do you think the infinite banking concept will perform in the next financial crisis?
Well, if you get enough people that understand this, you have a tipping point out there. You get 10% of the people understanding that this is true, then it becomes normal behavior. It goes viral. There's all kind of proof out there that that is true. But you don't have to have everybody doing it. That's just it. As a result of my teaching and practicing what I've been teaching, my wife and I and my family, I have 3 children, 10 grandchildren, 9 greats, and a 10th one on the way. And within our family, we haven't seen a bank in over 30 years. You see, people say, you don't have a checking account? Of course we have a checking account, but that's not banking. Good grief. Classify things correctly. That's accounting. That's not banking. Banking is loans. And you see, banks are lending money that doesn't exist, and that is fraud, and that is evil to the core.
Right.
But people don't recognize that because the secret elite keep it from them. They're not about to tell you that they lend money that doesn't exist.
So how did you come to be using this system?
Well, again, I became a Christian, as I told you, when I was 9. Now, I am very, and I'm a forester by education, but the first year of college, there's those basic courses. I am very proud of the fact that I made a D-plus in economics 101. Now, that's Delta plus. It's not Bravo plus, okay? That way, I didn't have so much nonsense to wash out of my brain. And so when I got up there, Air Force in 54, went to work in Eastern North Carolina, Johnson County, North Carolina is tobacco country. That's the second largest tobacco county in the world. Well, at the time that I moved there in 1954, things were quite different. Tobacco was a commodity. It was tightly controlled by the government folks, whatever. Now, you were only allowed to plant so much tobacco based on your open land that you had, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, tell me then, what would every tobacco farmer do when they planted tobacco? They overplanted,
mm-hmm.
didn't they?
Yes, sir.
And nobody had to tell you that, did you? Okay. All right, so they had an army of people that working for the county would go out to your tobacco farm and measure off how much you had overplanted and make you destroy that. Hmm. Now, because that was the biggest money producer in that county, that kind of thinking spilled over into the general economy.
Hmm.
Well, I immediately ran into the, being a Christian, I said, this doesn't square with my Christian upbringing at all. This is crazy. And so here I am mouthing off at a social gathering at the home of this radiologist and about what I run into. He says, sound like you need to read this book. Went back to his library, got Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. Have you read that?
Yes. I'm aware of the concepts, yeah.
All right. Anyway, so I read it. In less than 10 days, I've got it back in his hands, and I said, I have two questions. Where you guys been hiding this stuff? And the second question, why did you hide it from me? He says, well, if you like what you read, get on this mailing list of this journal called the Freeman, put out by the Foundation for Economic Education, Irvington, New York. He says, now all you got to do is ask for it. Now, they're supported entirely by donations, and they will never ask you for money. But if you aren't thrown some money in a year's time, they just take you off the mailing list. That's all it is to it. Well, Pastor, the more I read, the better it got. And I became particularly drawn to the writings of Leonard E. Reed. Now, Leonard E. Reed, his last occupation was the president of the Chamber of Commerce, the world's largest chamber of commerce, Los Angeles, California. And through a series of incidents, he was led to create the Foundation for Economic Education, along with Henry Hazlitt. There were about five other guys there, but Leonard was the driving force. And if it weren't for Leonard Reed, we would we wouldn't know Austrian economics as we know it today. Because, you see, it was his influence that, Menger started the Austrian school. And Eugen von Bewerk was one of his successors, but the real hero that came along was Ludwig von Mises. I guess you know about him.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so Mises, he could debunk the nonsense of socialism so fast it would make your head swim. And he had two things against him when the Nazis were coming into Vienna. First of all, he was Jewish, but the second thing is he could see through socialism and explain it so well that they wanted to kill him. Well, he and Margit put whatever they could in suitcases and escaped into Switzerland for a period of time, but they were still after him. And they didn't want to be a burden to the Swiss, so they made contact with Henry Hazlitt at Foundation for Economic Education back before World War One was really World War II was getting started big time. And so Mises made that his point of operation for the rest of his life. Now, later on, 35 years ago, the Mises Institute got started by Lou Rockwell. Lou Rockwell used to be the head of director of seminars at Foundation for Economic Education. But anyway, it's located down at Auburn, Alabama. It's not part of Auburn University. But you see, here's the tragedy. Here's this state university. 99% of the people in Auburn don't have an idea that the Mises Institute is located there. But it has worldwide influence, and these are very close friends of mine. But Leonard E. Reed was my personal friend and mentor. I learned more from that guy than anybody ever. And all of his writings are available through Foundation for Economic Education, now located in Atlanta, Georgia. And yours truly is a charter member of the Leonard E. Reed Society. There's only 100 of us in the world. And so I take pride in that very much. But only the Austrians have got it right. There's Keynesian fools out there. My number two man was Clarence Carson. Clarence was a historian, but he wrote from an economic point of view and was a native here in Alabama. I met him through Foundation for Economic Education, and my wife and I worked with him for some 22 years before he died. And Dr. Paul Cleveland is here in Birmingham, Alabama, and I'll be having lunch with him here shortly today. Anyway, I met Paul through Foundation for Economic Education, and it wasn't too long before I'd drawn him into the support group for Dr. Clarence Carson. And Clarence Carson was the one who taught Paul how to write books. The three of us became such good friends that when Clarence died, Paul and I got to conduct his funeral. So God is good. Anyway, then there's the other school out there. There's the Chicago School. Do you know about Milton Friedman?
Yes, sir.
Well, people consider him to be a free market economist, but no, he's a monetarist. There's got to be that constant increase in the money supply. So there we are, right back to the central bank idea and so forth. Only the Austrians got it right, because it's bottom-up thinking. It's not top-down thinking. Mises is a big book was entitled Human Action. And it has to do with human individual behavior, not group thinking. Not group thinking.
Right.
And so you see how that is perfectly attuned with the Christian belief. That it doesn't matter what other people are doing out there. What matters is, do I have a personal relationship with a fellow named Jesus Christ?
Mm, amen.
And I can't do it for my children. I can't do it for anybody that I know. They've got to make that decision themselves. And so that's the uniqueness of the Austrian school. It's bottom-up thinking.
Can you give a summary of how Keynesian economics and the central planning and the central banking leads to issues in the money supply and leads to issues in the economy more broadly?
Well, you see, the thing that I started out there with Cecil Rhodes and so forth, that's just the epitome of Keynesian thinking, you see. Keynes came from that particular elite group in the British Empire.
Hmm.
And none of it made real sense at all, but it's amazing how people are attracted to nonsense. We don't have to look very far to notice that that's true. So the increase in the money supply there is a means of controlling people's minds. And the bankers know that the easiest way for them to make lots of money is wars.
Hmm.
You gotta have wars. And you gotta have wars, you gotta have lots of money. But this doesn't register, again, because they control the thinking of human beings. That, well, I put it this way, Pastor. My observation in these 88 years, and from what I've told you so far, is that one of the biggest problems is Christians abandoned the responsibility of teaching their kids about 1860 in this 50 in this country, and they turned it over to the devil. Well, homeschoolers out there today is big time. I had just a chance meeting here about 4 months ago. I'm getting my hair cut by this young lady. I found out that she was a homeschooler and her father was a pastor. And she has 11 siblings and they're all homeschooled and such.
Hmm.
Well, you see, when Mary and I were working with Dr. Clarence Carson, the historian, we worked big time with homeschoolers. And it should never be called homeschooling. See, people get the idea that homeschooling is mama sitting around the kitchen table with the kids. No, it should be called market schooling. Any resource out there. You see, I told you I was an aviator, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I've been around the life insurance business for 55 years now. And several years ago, I had an associate who's younger, and his boy was 13, I believe, and being homeschooled. Well, my associate and I have a client to go see down in Louisiana. And so we take the boy along. Well, I've taught my associate how to fly the airplane. And so here I am teaching him geography, timber types, land types, explaining meandering streams, why are certain people in this particular area, so forth. That's market schooling.
Hmm.
Any resource out there. It doesn't have to be, but you know, people think that they've got to have a diploma of some sort. Do you know who Walter E. Williams is?
Yes, sir.
I've been knowing Walter 32 years. What a fun guy he is, so forth. He says half the kids in college should never have been there.
Hmm.
Yeah. And you notice that what happened at the end of World War II, here's all these soldiers and sailors and whatnot coming off of active duty, millions. And the socialists who were in charge at that time says, oh, that's going to ruin the economy. So that was absurd, but still they were in charge. And there we go. Well, they say we've got to give them something to do that they'll transition into the general economy over a period of time. Let's send them to college. Not only that, that will increase our intellectual capital in our country. Well, Pastor, what did it produce? It produced diploma mills. We have people out there that have a diploma that can't read the diploma.
Yes, sir.
Well, you see, Walter saw all this perfectly. Tom DiLorenzo, do you know him?
Yeah, I know of him.
Tom's one of my real heroes, and boy, oh boy, oh boy, just anything that you read by those guys and do so, they help out a great deal.
What is the system that you are encouraging people to employ? How should they go about learning about how to use it and how to secede from the system individually to get away from a centrally planned, to get away from being vulnerable to the ups and downs of a centrally planned economy?
Well, I have a website, infinitebanking.org, or you can just Google R. Nelson Nash, the Nelson Nash Institute. The directors are Carlos Lara, a great businessman up in Nashville. Bob Murphy is the most published Austrian economist out there today. David Stearns is my son-in-law, and he's our admin person, and I'm the fourth member. And we created the Institute there as an educational organization. We won't let anybody go through the course until they first meet with us for about an hour to make sure that we are like minds and so forth, and our goals are the same. And we have practitioners all over the United States and so forth. And when you go to our site there, there's a practitioner finder and so forth that all over the United States and Canada.
If you had 5 minutes with somebody to give them a strategy for preparing for the next downturn in our economy, could you give us just a few points that you would say these are the things you need to have in place to prepare?
It's not things. It's a message. It's just like Paul was back talking to those Corinthians back there. You've got to start the mental process. You got to get the understanding as to what's going on. And when you go to my website, there's a tab called Resources. And when you click it on, there's the contents that drop down. And one of them is a reading list. And there's about 285 books on that reading list. And if you read all those, you got one PhD in Austrian economics and one PhD in history. Mm. There are more history books than there are economics books, because you can't study history without understanding, can't understand economics rather, without understanding history.
So if somebody had their thinking right, though, what could you lay out some pieces that would be part of a sound economic portfolio or sound economic plan for weathering a storm?
The best thing that they can do is see all the podcasts and videos and things like that that Carlos and Bob have put together and so forth that address this thing particularly, specifically. So I'll just have to stop right there with that recommendation.
Okay. Nelson, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Ruined your whole day, didn't I?
That was great. It was an education, absolutely, so thank you.
A joy to be with you, Pastor.
As we close out this episode, I just wanted to take an opportunity and read you this obituary of Nelson's life. A pretty incredible guy, and I just wanted to share with you some more about who he was, as he's gone now. He's gone to be with Jesus. He's gone to meet those folks he was talking about there in the episode. He's seeing them face to face, as he said, not in the not too distant future, he would get to meet them, and it was true. So, Robert Nelson Nash of Birmingham, Alabama, beloved husband of Mary Edwards Nash,
passed away as a result of complications from heart disease on Wednesday, March 27, 2019, at the age of 88. Nelson was the son of the late Jewel Young Nash, Sr., and the late Sarah Annette Whitaker Nash. He was born March 15th of 1931 in Greene County, Georgia. Nelson grew up in Athens, Georgia, and graduated from the University of Georgia with a Bachelor's of Science degree in Forestry in 1952. Nelson served 2 years in the U.S. Air Force from 1952 to 1954 as an aerial photo interpreter with a Strategic Air Command at March Air Force Base in California. He and Mary moved to North Carolina, where he worked in forestry as a private consultant for 9 years. While there, he joined the North Carolina Army National Guard as a fixed-wing pilot. After attending Army Aviation School, he went on to earn Master Aviator wings during his 30 years of military service. In 1963, he moved the family to Birmingham to continue his work as a forestry consultant. 1 year later, he made a career change and entered the life insurance business. During his more than 35 years of experience as a life insurance agent, Nelson worked with the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the U.S. and with Guardian, recognized for his high achievements. Nelson was inducted as a Hall of Fame member by Equitable, a chartered life underwriter, and the life member of the Million Dollar Roundtable. In 2000, he wrote a book, Becoming Your Own Banker, which would go on to have a high impact on hundreds of thousands of people by teaching them how to create their own banking systems using dividend-paying whole life insurance. This book evolved into the infinite banking concept, and Nelson enjoyed traveling all over the U.S. and Canada to lecture on the topic as the founding director of the Nelson Nash Institute. He is also the author of Building Your Warehouse of Wealth and co-author of The Case for IBC. Nelson was a member of the First Baptist Church of Birmingham for 28 years. He had a lifelong passion for music and was a long-term choir member and frequent vocal soloist. He was a voracious reader, and he especially enjoyed studying Austrian economics and history. He also enjoyed aviation and travel, often piloting his family to destinations around North America in small aircraft. Nelson is survived by his loving wife of 66 years, Mary, and his three children, Debbie Nash Matthews of Anniston, Alabama, Dr. Barrington Nelson Nash of Knoxville, Tennessee, and Kimberly Nash Stearns, and his son-in-law David, whom he mentioned, of Birmingham. He's also survived by his 10 grandchildren, 9 great-grandchildren, in lieu of flowers, in Nelson's memory. I want to share this with you. In Nelson's memory, donations may be made to the First Baptist Church of Birmingham. So, pretty cool. Really appreciated that opportunity to sit down with Nelson and to record this episode before his passing. Very, very much count it as one of the great privileges of this venture that I've been on with the podcast, and just really such a testimony of the hope that we have in Jesus there from Nelson, to say in just a few weeks, just a short time, I might be meeting those guys face to face, and he was ready to meet Jesus. So I really appreciate this opportunity. Encourage you to tune in to the next episode, episode 93 with Carlos Lara, where we're going to take this foundation that Nelson laid for us of the deep history of financial difficulties in our world, and we're going to take that forward into the recent history and the future, and how we prepare for financial troubles created by central planning and central banking in our world. So appreciate the opportunity to share these things with you guys, and I look forward to more episodes coming out in the near future on the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.